person can be bought or sold. Sex buyers or johns drive the illegal sex trade. Without their money, pimps and human traffickers have zero incentives. No buyers means no business. You can learn how to turn your concern to action at demandabolition.org. You're listening to 90.1 KPFT Houston, kpft.org online.
That smooth beat of Ray Lynch's Clouds Below Your Knees signals it is 8 p.m. on Thursday and time once again for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston, Texas, devoted entirely to storytelling. And it's only on Houston's KPFT 90.1 FM. I'm your host this evening, Greg Audell, along with Floyd the Wonder Dog, who, as always, is snuggled up next to me, and along with the best team on radio, co-hosts Drs. Warren Holloman, Mary Edgerton, and Hank Rubicek, as well as our absolute all-star team of guest hosts, Eric Heen, Chris Gorman, Harwood Taylor, and Paul Tabikian. We are thrilled to bring you storytellers from ages 10 to 100, and from every possible walk of life and corner of the globe. And I want to thank you for taking time this Thanksgiving to join us. While this is certainly an atypical Thanksgiving, and most of us are not with at least some of the people we would love to be around, I'm glad you've chosen to spend part of your evening with us. I'll ask you to have an extra piece of pie for me, and maybe even one for Floyd and all rescue dogs if you're so inclined. Please send us a picture of your favorite pie to the So What's Your Story Facebook page. That way we can all share in them together, even if virtually. The So What's Your Story team has a great deal to be thankful for this year. First and foremost, we are thankful that our producer, creator, and above all friend, Dr. Hank Rubicek, and his fantastic wife, Peggy, have both recovered from the worst effects of the coronavirus. I believe they were patients number 62 and 63 in Houston all the way back in March. So they were treated at the earliest stages of the pandemic, and we're just so thankful that they are regaining their health. We're thankful for Marcia Holloman, wife of our own, Warren Holloman, who as a family doctor is on the very front lines of this epidemic, as are our own Dr. Mary Edgerton, Dr. Ruth Wentz, and Chris Gorman, who each in their own way are risking their own health and welfare for those they serve and ultimately for every single one of us. And we're thankful for you, our audience who has been with us and grown with us for over 13 years and almost 700 episodes. And we're thankful to the thousands of storytellers who have shared their stories with us. We've learned something from each and every one of them. To protect host, guest, and staff, the KPFT studios remain closed during the pandemic. So we're sharing a mix of old and new programs. Tonight, we'll be revisiting my shows with storytellers Reverend Jonathan Page, Elizabeth Ruiz, Harwood Taylor, and Joseph Especia, whose stories touch upon unexpected lessons and experiences they were grateful for. As always, if you have a story you'd like to share, tell us about it on our Facebook page. And to learn more about the happenings in the Houston storytelling community, please check out the Houston Story Guild at HoustonStorytellers.org. They're a vital part of our story. Now let's sit back, relax, and enjoy some stories.
Reverend Page is the senior minister at the First Congregational Church of Houston, one of the most progressive churches that I know of. With a bachelor's degree from Harvard and a master's of divinity from Yale Divinity School, he has also published extensively and is now completing his second book, a novel focused on Christian faith and set in the Niger Delta. In reading about Jonathan, I was moved by this quote of his: "People are hungry for a church that rejects biblical literalism, affirms the compatibility of science and religions, welcomes the LGBT Christians, and has a passion for social justice." That's very much like the church I was raised in, particularly the social justice aspect. And I think, in my view, there's no better community to be a part of. So welcome to So What's Your Story, Jonathan Page.
Thank you very much, Greg. It's great to be here, and it's great to be hanging out with fellow progressives who might be listening online.
We have a few of those, not exclusively, but we do have a healthy progressive audience. It's a tough question, but give us your sense about the reason it becomes difficult for many to accept differences in others.
Well, I'll give you the Christian perspective anyway. For Christians, it's always the root of us not being able to accept others is sin. And I know that's a tough word for a lot of people to hear. More progressive Christians see sin as a question of separation. When we're separated from ourselves, separated from one another, separated from God, we tend to put people in boxes, and you see stories coming up in the Bible again and again that reference this, going back to the Tower of Babel and, you know, through the story of the Good Samaritan and others.
Seems like people are much more accepting of their own sins than they are those other people's sins.
Right. Especially when those other people are different by some arbitrary category, whatever it might be.
Right. Your first story looks at a chance encounter that leads to both understanding and healing. Would you share that story with us?
Yeah, sure. So this story starts way back when I was a college chaplain. So my first job at a seminary, I was a college chaplain at Harvard. And in addition to being a college chaplain, I was a residential advisor for 36 freshmen in a dorm. And, you know, kids, 18, 19-year-old kids, are at a great point in life because not only are they away from home for the first time, but they're also able to question everything under the sun. And one of the students in the dorm, who was on the same floor as I was, let's call him Sean. Sean was the son of a Lutheran minister. And like a lot of preacher's kids, if there's one thing that Sean had no time for, it was religion. And so, just his luck to be put in the dorm where the dorm head was a minister and a chaplain. So we would have debates that oftentimes raged late into the night about religion, and Sean, like most people who don't like Christianity, had read up on his Christopher Hitchens and his Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris and all those folks. And so he would be spouting out this reason or that reason, and I would calmly, at least try to calmly, respond to him. And we would oftentimes go for a couple hours arguing about the nature of God. And he said at one point, he said, "You know, John," he said, "I may not agree with you, but this is the first time I've heard arguments that actually might make sense, but you're still wrong." I'm like, "Okay, thank you, Sean." So after freshman year, he went his way, and I continued on my way. And then I left Harvard and taught high school in a Christian high school and then ended up in Iowa. And after that, I was actually visiting New York randomly. And this truly was random. I mean, I haven't been in New York since then, and that was 4 years ago. So I was in New York, and it just so happened that I ended up staying with a friend, and this friend worked out at the Harvard Club of New York. Now, I had never been in the Harvard Club of New York, but hey, if they had a gym and if I could get in for free and work out, I mean, sign me up. So went down with this buddy of mine, Rob, and we went into the Harvard Club, and we go up, and of course, on the second floor of the Harvard Club in New York is this beautiful library, and knowing me, it's like I immediately gravitate to the library, so I start looking through these books, and as I'm looking through these books, I realize there's someone else who's also in the library looking through books. And I turn around, and there's this guy, Sean, who I haven't seen since he was 19 years old. And we start talking, and he now lives in San Francisco. And he was in New York to do job recruiting for the company he worked for. And he had never been in the Harvard Club in New York either.
Wow.
So for both of us, neither of us had been there before. I doubt either one of us have been there since. And we both happened to be in the library at the same time. So we start chatting. And I'm like, oh, how are things going? And he's like, oh, things are good. And I said, well, you have any plans in New York? He said, well, I'm just here for a day. And I'm like, great. And I'm like, well, what are you doing tonight? And he said, well, I'd love to grab dinner with you, John, but I've got to go to an NA meeting first. And so I thought to myself, an NA meeting? So this, and so all of a sudden my mind starts racing, you know. So he's going to a Narcotics Anonymous meeting somewhere in Manhattan. And I had to go to a friend's 50th birthday party that evening. And, you know, I said, well, here's my number. If something comes up, you know, or if you still want to grab some food, you know, let me know. So I'm at this, you know, birthday party. And sure enough, after I'm there for maybe an hour or so, I get this buzz on my phone. And it's this student, Sean, wanting to, he's like, yeah, hey, if we can get together, I'd love to catch up. So I'm in a situation where I have to leave this party and this friend who I never see to go meet this person. But I knew he had gone to an NA meeting. So we went out, we sat down, and he told me this long story. This story of his time at Harvard that I had never known, where he, while he was in his fraternity, became deeply addicted to Xanax. That was his drug of choice. And he talked about what that was like. And he also talked about his journey back to God. He said, John, you'll find this funny, but this is, it's brought me back to faith. And he's like, I still remember those conversations that we had. So we talked. I was expecting to spend maybe 30 minutes talking. We ended up talking for well over an hour. By the time I made it back to the party, it was basically over. And I was a little bummed about that, but I was like, okay, it was great to catch up with this guy. And the next morning I wake up and I've got a text message on my phone. And it was this student. And he said, John, thanks for meeting with me. I just want to let you know you probably saved my life last night. And it was one of those texts you don't often get, but clearly he was in a lot worse place than he had seen. And he was thinking about making some really bad life choices that maybe were ones that would be hard to recover from. And it was just, it was one of those things where, again, I haven't seen him since then. I mean, this is, what are the chances?
How do you explain that?
I don't know.
I mean, for me, I call it the hand of God.
I mean, I would too. I mean, given my profession, I certainly would. This is the tricky Christian notion of providence. How do you deal with providence? And, you know, there's always those times in your life where you look back on life and you say, gosh, it seems as though there's a plan here. There seems as though something led us to this. And yet, in the midst of living life, oftentimes it can seem so random.
Well, it's also interesting to me, you know, that you were there for a big event. But something told you to walk away from it.
Yeah, it wasn't easy. Part of me was tempted to text this guy back and say, "Hey, can we catch up tomorrow?" I mean, again, I don't go to New York often, and my friend who was having his 50th birthday, I don't see very often. So, but yeah.
What's the lesson you'd like us to take from this story?
Well, I think it's a lesson that we get in our life in various times, which is you never know how important small interactions can be. I mean, just small. I mean, here's another story. I know I shouldn't be, you know, interjecting more stories, but this story actually fits in, and hopefully you don't mind, you know, squeezing it in. So this is a person in my congregation in Iowa told a story about his grandfather, who was a bank teller. And as a bank teller, he was sitting at the bank, and he was there, and he tells one story about how he greeted someone there at the bank and just said hi to him and asked him how he was doing. This guy that day was about to go rob that bank.
Oh, wow.
And he was so struck by someone actually asking him how he was doing that he left the bank, threw the gun away, and made a change in his life. And the guy who actually was nice to him at the time never found out about this story before he died.
Really?
It was just his grandson that had been told it.
Wow.
By a family member when he went back to that town. But even that small interaction that you might never know, you never know how big those chance interactions can change people's lives.
Score one for unexpected moments of kindness.
You never know.
It's so easy just to walk by each other and ignore each other, but you never do know.
Elizabeth Ruiz is an expert in organizational communication. Her passion is helping people to improve behavior so that they can reach their potential in both their business and individual lives. I am clearly going to have to talk to Elizabeth when this is done. I need someone like that in my life. Elizabeth completed a Bachelor of Science Communication at U of H Downtown and plans to pursue a master's. She spends time mentoring, creating leaders, and volunteering because giving back to the community is, in her words, the foundation for successful training is learning. Among her many accolades, Elizabeth recently earned first place in the second annual University of Houston Downtown Public Speaking Competition. I look forward to hearing some more about that. Joseph Espithia, did I get that right, Joseph?
Nailed it.
All right. Is a native Houstonian who was first in his family to graduate college, receiving a degree in political science, all right, good fellow political science major, from Texas State University in San Marcos. Like all of us political science majors, he is now doing something else. He works in natural gas trading as a scheduler and is eager to undertake new adventures, which can lead to new stories. He does sound like one of us. I think that's how every storyteller looks at life. You know, there's good, bad, but everything's a story. Like many of us who you hear on this program, as we've done over the years, Joseph recently got up his nerve to step onto that Moth stage for the very first time a few months ago. And wouldn't you know it, last week's Moth, and a night filled with great storytellers, he emerged victorious. That is no small feat, my friend. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
I'm proud of you. And last but certainly not least, Harwood Taylor is a longtime friend of this program and is also a former Moth Story Slam champion. Harwood is always able to lead me into his stories so thoroughly, I often forget where I am, and that's the mark of a gifted storyteller. And Harwood, thank you for joining us. It is always a special evening when you are here.
Well, it's always special when I'm here. Thank you for inviting me.
And Elizabeth, welcome to the studios.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I understand you've been in this studio before on a program, but this is your first time on So What's Your Story. Is that correct?
Correct.
Well, I am glad we have you. And Joseph, have you been on radio before?
Never. This is a first for me.
All right. Well, I can already tell you've got a good radio voice, so you don't have to worry about that.
Right on.
No, I am really, really excited to have all of you here. Now, Elizabeth, you've been in the communication business for over 30 years. Is that correct?
Correct. 32.
Wow. What is it about the discipline that captivates you and keeps you interested in all this after all this time?
Well, actually, nonverbal communication to me is the most important. It's the majority of communication. You can tell a lot about someone by watching them and then speaking with them afterwards. I enjoy communication. And I also like to people watch. The thing that I really like is...
Another mark of a good storyteller.
Yes. You can make up a lot of stories by just people watching.
Absolutely. What is it that intrigues you about crafting a good story?
That's a very good question. I would say right now, inspiring people.
Oh, wow. I like that. I wasn't expecting that answer. Your first story reminds us of the absolute unpredictability and fragility of life. Would you tell us your story?
Yes. Well, I want you to imagine getting a call right now from a person you love the most. They tell you they are trapped hundreds of miles away and have a few seconds to live. I wanted to tell you that they love you and goodbye. This happened to me. I was trapped under seven stories of rubble, soot, and debris with my children. Thought I was going to die any second. I had cell phone reception and called my mother to tell her goodbye. What would you do? Today, I'm going to tell you my story and how it changed my life. It was a bright, early, sunny morning When I was getting my 3-year-old ready for his first day of preschool, when I heard a loud explosion, it sounded like a bomb going off. It shook our high rise. I immediately ran to pull my older son out of school. It was behind our apartment building, and we ran into a fleeing crowd of thousands of people to try to get our car out of the garage. By the time we made it, it was roped off, and we were ordered to run towards the water. Then a second plane was coming. Halfway, running back to my building, we watched the second plane fly into the World Trade Center. We were frozen, watching it burn and people jumping to their death, hearing their bodies hit the pavement. It was horrific. I felt the building was about to fall, so I ran to my apartment building across the street from World Trade Center to grab a few things before fleeing out of New York. We took the elevator to the 12th floor, but in a few seconds, a fireman broke down our door and told us to run down the stairs and run towards the water immediately. By the time we hit the first floor, we witnessed the sunny day turn black, soot and debris fall all around us. We found ourselves in the basement of our apartment with a group of strangers. I organized the 7 adults in a circle and the 6 children in a circle inside the adult circle. Knowing my children were about to die, I began organizing the group. It was chaos. I was organizing it into peace and calm as much as I could for them, for my children's sake. My cell phone miraculously had service. I shared with the group. I would make the first call for 2 minutes, then pass the phone to the person on my right, and so on until the phone dropped connection. We all called a loved one to tell them we were trapped in a basement, that we loved them, and goodbye. No one called for help. We all knew we were going to die any second. Everyone had a chance to make a call before service died. 2 hours later, New York firemen found us. We were the last group of people to be found alive. We had just the clothes on our backs and lost everything. We had to rebuild our lives. We lived in 3 hotels and temporary housing for a year until we found another place to live. I have used this event to help others. I have gone back to school to finish my degree and inspire others to not wait for a 9/11 to happen, to rise to the top, follow who you are now. Don't wait. You can thrive no matter what. There is greatness in all of us, and sometimes it goes untapped until a crisis. Find your potential now. Don't wait. I would like to leave you with this. Decide to go for your dreams now and make a call to someone you love tonight to say hello, not goodbye.
Wow, Elizabeth. I can understand how you can't tell that with a dry eye. It's hard to hear with a dry eye. That may be one of the most powerful stories I've heard. I mean, your story is such a powerful reminder that every victim of the 9/11 attack started their day as normally as any day of their lives. What is, I mean, in a day filled with memories, what is your most vivid memory of that day?
Holding my children in my arms.
What is their most vivid memory?
Unfortunately, the second plane hitting the building and people falling.
And how old were they at the time?
3 and 7.
Does the one who was 3 have any memories?
Well, when he was 3, he would talk. Back then, Digimon was very popular. And he would tell us that Digimon was in the Hudson River and he was going to find the terrorists. So that was his memory.
Now, all these years later, how has it impacted them? Or is it something that's not discussed much?
No, we talk about it during 9/11 anniversary. When you're a survivor, you're registered with the World Trade Center Health Registry, and they email you a questionnaire, and you have to answer questions about your mental and physical health, and they keep a permanent record of it, and they post it for the public to read annually. And wow. So we do have to go through that.
Have your children written their own stories?
No, they have not. Actually, my 19-year-old, who was 3 at the time, He has written two papers on it, and he also made a speech about it as well at his college.
Wow. Wow.
My older son, he is he's in the Navy. He's in the military. He's a Navy nuclear engineer fighting for our country now.
Wow. Wow, you've got a lot to be proud of. And yes. You know what? So do they. They have a lot to be proud of in you.
Thank you.
Do you feel that? Do you recognize that? I can see in your face you're not so sure.
I'm very proud of my children, so well, I try to do the best.
I always tell people, you know, my motto is good kids do not just happen. They do
I agree.
Not just happen.
I agree.
Well, my friends, you are listening to So What's Your Story on 90.1 KPFT Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 for our friends in Huntsville. My guest storytellers are Elizabeth Ruiz, Joseph Espithia, and Harwood Taylor. Now, Joseph, I want to thank you for making the effort to be here tonight, because I understand that we are about to lose you to Utah?
Unfortunately, yes.
In the very near future, what in the world is dragging you from the Houston storytelling scene to Utah?
I know. And, you know, I wish I had a more interesting story for my reasons of leaving, but it really is because of my job. And, you know, I'm hoping this kind of transition can kind of lead to newer stories and more exciting tales to be told.
Well, I would say that attitude might well come from one of the stories you're going to share with us tonight. I mean, like me, you were lucky enough to spend part of your 20s in what I consider the most amazing city on the face of the earth, Washington, D.C. What did you think of the place after that buildup?
You know what? I loved it. I wouldn't mind going back anytime soon. I mean, it's just a level of diversity. It is just an energy that can't be matched, maybe with New York or something. But
well, it's also, if you're going to be broke, it's the world's best city to be broke in. All the museums are free.
Absolutely.
There's always something going on the mall. I mean, you can live very, and then you can just sneak into receptions, as I'm not going to admit whether I did or not, but there's always receptions every hotel you go to there.
Of course.
Would you share your story with us?
Absolutely. Okay, so about 5 years ago, I'm in my apartment in San Marcos, Texas, and I'm a junior in college at this time, and I'm eagerly waiting a phone call from the Houston Astros. I had just interviewed with them the week prior, and I was waiting for a phone call because they said they would call me to let me know if I, you know, received the internship or not. And so as I'm waiting, I eventually get a phone call, but it's from Washington, D.C., and the man on the other end of this line, you know, he sounds like Dana Carvey's impression of Ross Perot. and to me, it sounds hokey. I'm like, there's no way this is real. And he's explaining to me, you know, I found your application online, something I had filled out months prior. And he explains to me, how would you like to intern at the Library of Congress in D.C.? It would be fully paid. We would pay for your flight, your apartment, and we would also pay you for your work. So once again, this sounds too good to be true. And the more I'm talking to him, the more I'm like, okay, I'm doing this. I'm definitely doing this. So, you know, I'm so happy about this, and I tell my friends, and they plan a big celebration for me, and I'm super excited about it. And all my friends come out. We go, you know, it's San Marcos. A lot of people like to have fun there. So
really?
Oh yeah. So everybody comes out, and you know, it's bittersweet because people are, you know, this may be the last time they ever see me, depending on how this goes. And so, you know, for 4 months I'll be gone. And so after the celebration, I go on my way. And at the time, you know, I tell my girlfriend at the time, I gotta go. I love you. I'm sorry, but you know, this has to happen, and we're going to try to maintain everything. And once I'm there, you know, going, experiencing the city, learning the ins and outs, and it's just a wonderful place. Like you said, there's always something to do. There's never a dull moment. And at a certain point in time, I get invited to a gala, a really nice Library of Congress gala. It's a black tie affair. I'm totally unfamiliar with this. I don't know what it is. I'm out of my element with these kind of things. You know what I mean? I'm just a 21-year-old kid who's being thrown to the wolves, basically. And this was probably the later half of my internship. And right before this, I had just been dumped. She could no longer be in a long-distance relationship, and I was just heartbroken, devastated. It was terrible. And so, naturally, I'm not too excited about this gala, but I'm trying to make the best of it. And once I go to it, the library itself is just lit up. It is beautiful. It's empty. I mean, usually there's tourists everywhere, and it's just crawling with Pulitzer Prize winners, Nobel Prize winners, celebrities. I'm totally out of my element once again, you know what I mean? And there's food, and I don't want to eat the food because I feel like that would be tacky. And their drinks are flowing, and it's just beautiful. It's gorgeous. Well, as the night goes on, it ends up being this huge dance party. And it's nothing but, you know, the younger interns like myself having the grand old time. And it's the most unprofessional thing I've ever seen. And so as I'm there, and I'm sad, and I'm not really enjoying it, and I'm just totally in my own head, I slowly start coming around little by little. And so I go and I grab my boss and I bring him out there to the dance floor and we start dancing and acting goofy. I go and grab his bosses. These are all government officials. You know what I mean? I grab all these people. We're out there dancing and they're with the 20 plus year olds and we're having a grand old time. And I took a minute after that and I walk away and I walk to the bar to get drinks. And I look around and I look at this grand celebration, this massive thing that I never thought I would be part of. And it's amazing. It's epic. And it really put things in perspective for me. Here I am wallowing in whatever I'm dealing with. And none of these people know what I'm dealing with. They have no idea. Right. And so that truly does put things in perspective. And I see, wow, like this, look at the grand scheme of things here, buddy. Look what's going on. So that pretty much wrapped up my internship in DC, and soon after that I was on my way home. And so if you look at it, my internship, it started with a celebration and it ended with a celebration, and in between there were some really valuable lessons learned with that.
Wow, I can picture myself in every bit of that story. I remember being 21 years old at a reception at the State Department, and this very old man came past me, and it was Armin Hammer, the grandfather of the actor. And just like you, I was like, what business do I have talking to Armin Hammer? I mean, what business? And then you realize, wow, all these important people got here because they were 21-year-old kids once, you know?
Absolutely.
And, you really do a good job of capturing, you know, what it is like to be 21 in D.C. As we are in the midst of the holiday season, I would love to hear your story about Thanksgiving, if you'd share your second story with us.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, my time in D.C., I'm away from family, and I don't really have Thanksgiving plans. And, you know, word of mouth, it became known that I could possibly go to Baltimore for Thanksgiving and spend time with a family I had never met. And so, naturally, that's a little weird for anyone. So I said, you know what, sure, we'll do that. And so this is my first time ever being on a train going from city to city. And so anyone who lives in Texas all their life, this is totally foreign to you, that you could hop on a train and be in a city within a matter of minutes, you know. So I go to Baltimore and I'm extremely nervous about this situation. I'm extremely, I guess, a little uncomfortable because I've never done anything like this. I've never been on a train like this to go from city to city. And what you don't realize is that you really have to pay attention with these kind of train rides, because they don't warn you that you're approaching your stop, per se. They don't really make an official announcement. It's just kind of like you got to be paying attention when they stop and look outside the window and see where you are. And so I was really close to missing my stop, and fortunately I caught it in time. So when I get off the train, I walk off and I go into the train station and I see this older African-American gentleman. He's wearing a golf cap. He's wearing a denim jacket. He's very stylish looking, and he's holding a makeshift little cardboard sign with my name on it. And so I was like, okay, clearly he's here for me. So I go up and I introduce myself, and he says, yeah, I'm here to pick you up. I'm going to take you to where you need to go. So where I was going, it was this how do I explain this? The woman that I had been talking to up to this point, she was a grandmother, she was an aunt, she was a mother, she was, you know, just the quintessential mother of the, I guess you could say, the head of the family, so to speak. And so we had been talking up to this point. She was super nice and super inviting and super welcoming. So we get in his car, and of course he's driving this old Monte Carlo, and it's just very fitting for the kind of gentleman that he is and the way he looks. And I'm like, okay, this should be interesting. And so we go on our way downtown Baltimore, and he's showing me Johns Hopkins, and he's showing me where the Orioles play. And I'm thinking, okay, that's pretty cool. And we're still on our way. And then he says, okay, well, I'm going to make a stop real quick. I hope you don't mind. And, you know, what can I say? I'm visiting, so sure. Yeah, let's do it. So we pull over to the side of the road, and the part of town that we're in, it's if you're familiar with the show The Wire, this is where they filmed The Wire, and he let me know that right away.
Wow.
So you can get a pretty good idea of the demographic, the situation. So we stop at some project housing, and he gets out, and he's walking towards the sidewalk, and I get out right. He's like, well, you can get out if you want. And I'm like, okay, sure. I have no idea where I'm at. Of course I'll get out. So I start following him, and there's a gentleman standing in front of this house on the sidewalk, and his back is facing me. And he turns around, and he says, oh, hey, uncle. And he's referring to the gentleman I'm with. But when I look at the guy, I notice he's buckling and zipping his pants up, and I'm thinking, what is going on here? And he has this long urine stain all the way to his foot, and I'm thinking, okay, this is a little bizarre. But he doesn't acknowledge it. No one acknowledges it for some reason. It's just it's a thing. So he greets his uncle, and then he tries to greet me, but naturally I'm reluctant because I don't know what just happened, so I try to weasel my way out of it by, you know, pointing at something or making a reference to something. So then the gentleman that's driving me, he goes inside, and I have no idea what he did. He's gone for about 15 minutes, and I'm still standing on this sidewalk, and I'm looking around, and I see families passing by, young mothers passing by with their kids. It's a very active neighborhood, and I'm thinking, where am I? And I stick out like a sore thumb, you know what I mean? Clearly, I'm not from there. So then he comes back outside, and he says, okay, you ready to go? And I'm like, yeah, of course I'm ready to go. I don't know where we are. What's going on? I'm trying to get to this house for Thanksgiving. So then we eventually leave. Once we get going, he says, hey, I got to make one more stop. And I'm thinking, oh boy, I'm never going to get to this house. We stop at his house this time. His daughter's in the house. She's cooking. She's with her daughters, his grandkids. And he sits me in the living room. He says, I'll be right back. And he goes upstairs. And then when I look at his wall, he's got this 8-foot shelf, and it's about 4 foot high, and it's filled with albums. Nothing but albums. And he's got this amazing turntable, and I'm blown away. I'm like, this, who knew this existed in this man's house? I had no idea. And so he comes back downstairs. I'm like, what is this about? You know? And he starts explaining his love for music, which I also have a love for music. So we start bonding on that. So immediately we start clicking, and it feels very natural. And I'm thinking, this is like a hidden gem. If people only knew this existed in this little run down dilapidated house, there is this amazing record collection. So he says, hey, are you ready to go? Once again, I'm still, yes, I've been ready for a while. I feel like I've been in Baltimore all day. Eventually, we leave. We finally get to where we need to be. I walk into this house. There's nobody in it except for this woman, this older, she's probably mid-60s. And she's got this huge grin on her face, and she's so welcoming. And she's in the kitchen, and she's cooking everything. From fried chicken to crab soup to turkey to ham. I mean, this woman is doing it all. And I'm thinking, oh boy, am I early because there's no one here? And she explains to me, no, I probably wouldn't have done anything if you wouldn't have come. I probably just, we would have kept it simple. I probably would have gone somewhere. So I'm thinking, oh my gosh, you did this for me? She's like, well, yeah. So she sits me in the living room, and the Texans are playing that day. So she wants me to watch the game, and I'm watching it. She comes in and she serves me, and I'm blown away by this. And then, you know, later in the evening, little by little, some of her family members stop by, but by no means was there ever a formal sit down with the entire family at a table. Wow. And I'm thinking, this woman just did all of this for me. Somebody she's never met. She doesn't know what I look like. She just did this. This is how awesome she is, a genuine person. And so I get on the train that night. And as they drive me back to the train station, I'm kind of reflecting on the day. And, of course, she gives me a plate to go. And I'm on the train. I'm on my way back to D.C. And in my head, I'm like, wow, I was so nervous to go to this Thanksgiving dinner. And in that moment, I just felt totally at ease going back to D.C. I was so comfortable and fulfilled with a family I had never met. It was amazing.
Wow. It is an amazing story. There's so much to remind us of what and who and how we should be focused on during the holidays, as opposed to all the other garbage that gets in the way, I think. You know, I feel like you're, what happened to you was so pure.
Absolutely.
How did you come to be invited to this woman's house?
So it ended up being a family friend that was back in Houston that said, hey, if you're not doing anything, you could always go up to Baltimore. And that's how it all kind of came to fruition.
And, you know, I got to tell you what's funny. I've been on a train once in my life from D.C. to Baltimore for Thanksgiving.
No kidding.
Absolutely. My uncle lived in Baltimore.
What are the odds?
Yeah, yeah. So I, yeah, that's a wonderful story. And I don't even, part of a good story is I don't know much about this lady, but I love her from your story.
Yeah.
You know, I have a picture of her in my mind. I can picture her kitchen, bringing the food to you. That's beautiful.
In the beginning of this, it sounds so bizarre. And who knew it would end at such a positive note, you know?
But that's really true with both of your stories, that when you're willing to go down a path, you're really not sure where it's going to lead. It's amazing what you might find.
Absolutely.
Now, Harwood, the first time you were on the program, I believe, was all the way back in December of 2011. And you told a story about your dad. Hank hosted you, and that story has since been one of the most memorable ever told in almost 10 years on air. In fact, it made such an impression on our listeners that we often use it to demonstrate how moving stories can lift our collective spirit. So tonight, I want you to tell that story again, because for me, it reaches several layers of the human experience that most narratives don't end up touching.
Okay. Well, it touches me too. So if I get quiet,
it's okay.
It brings up some memories for me, so I just have to breathe through it. So I always remember loving my father's hands. My earliest memories are of his hands on a typewriter. And my eye level was right about the level of where his hands were, and he would type, and so he wrote for all the local papers. At the time, he was a freelance writer, wrote for the Chronicle, the Post, the Houston Press. This was in the 70s, early 70s. Anyway, there was just something about that. Also, that sound was ever present. You know, tit-tit-tit-tit-zitting, tit-tit-tit-zitting. I heard that constantly in my childhood. He also was an incredible artist, and he'd do these wonderful drawings, and he would use charcoal, so he would rub the drawings with his fingers and, you know, create shadows or contours. And he also did sculpture, and so watching his hands in wet clay was also just, there was a grace and a beauty about his hands that I knew up until, you know, his very late years. And just having coffee with him, watching him stir a cup of coffee, he would put in sugar, he would put in cream, he would stir three times and tip the spoon on the lip of the cup, and just the way he placed things, it was just, it's like a little work of art just watching his hands. My dad was also bipolar. And growing up, you know, a young family with an undiagnosed bipolar was really scary. And what it meant was that, you know, sometimes he could be incredibly kind and creative and funny and brilliant. And, you know, in a moment he could, you know, be unwittingly cruel to a young person, you know, and that was me and my sisters and brother. And so there were some incredibly joyful times, but there was always tension. And the way that manifested later in life is, you know, there were years that I didn't talk to my dad. My sisters for the last 15 years of my dad's life didn't talk to him. So those seeds of difficulty, you know, and just emotional distrust were constant throughout our lives. Anyway, I did do a lot of therapy, and I did some men's groups, and I learned through those men's groups to really, you know, forgive him, forgive myself. I mean, we're all doing the best we can do. Certainly my dad was. And I had breakfast with him every Sunday. And I remember one of my sisters saying, how do you do it? I said, how do what? Have breakfast with Daddy every Sunday. And I said, it's my service work. And I meant it. It wasn't fun. It was something that I had decided I was going to give to my elderly dad. And then he was 82 years old. He was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and it really scared me. And I got on the internet and I looked up everything about it. I found the Alzheimer's Association, amazing organization. The Alzheimer's Association, just, you know, incredibly kind people, incredibly useful things that, I mean, you could probably get on their website right now if you know somebody that has Alzheimer's and needs some help, and they, it could help you right now. So couldn't say enough good things about them. One of the things they had was an early onset class, which meant that the Alzheimer's patients would go into one room and the caregivers would go in the other room and we'd talk, and then we'd get back together for luncheon. And I just got, you know, both of our guards went down, and I got a lot closer to my dad, a lot closer. And, you know, part of it was just, you know, looking at him and thinking, you know, is one day is he going to look at me and not know who I am? You know, time was, there was a window that was for sure closing, and I wanted to take advantage of that. So it didn't make these breakfasts any easier. he was always just, it was just hard to trust emotionally where anything was going to go, but I was looking forward to these breakfasts now. And so I'm going for this obligatory breakfast every Sunday. It's not obligatory anymore. I want to go now. And I pick him up, we had breakfast, and so we're on the way home. And I'm driving along, and I look down, and I see my father's 82-year-old hand. This beautiful old hand. And I think, you know, I want to hold my father's hand. And so I'm driving, so I kind of waited until I got to a red light. And I stopped, and when I turned to, my intention was to hold his hand, I just was frozen in fear. And I couldn't believe it. I mean, like, what is this? And, you know, I thought, I've done all this therapy and this men's work. I mean, I can hold my father's hand. And then, you know, all these things started to come back, you know, cruel things that he might say. Would he pull his hand away? And then the light turned green. And so I started driving again, and I'm driving along and I'm thinking, this is important. I want to hold my father's hand. And come to another red light, and I look down, and I can't do it. And, you know, I just thought, yeah, I did this men's work and this therapy. I mean, this is what I did it for. My 82-year-old dad's not going to do anything to me. I mean, he's a vulnerable old man. I just want to hold my dad's hand. And then I started thinking, you know, when I was a little boy, how many times did my dad hold my hand? Was it every day? Well, yeah, probably was. So thousands of times. But I can't do it. So the light turns, and I remember turning onto Wall, and there was a stop sign, and we stopped, and there was a woman on a bench. I don't know why, but we kind of caught eyes, and then I remember looking at my hand. It was kind of low on the steering wheel, and his hand was on the middle console. And this was the scariest thing I ever did in my life. When I took my hand off the steering wheel, it was just 3 inches from my father's hand. It was like my foot had just left a 1,000-foot bungee jump or something. And when I touched his hand, immediately his other hand came over and rested on top of my hand. And it was so comfortable. You know, it was like we had been doing it all along. It was, you know, it was just the most beautiful thing. And, I'm so glad I did that, because, my dad lived for 2 more years, and, I can't say that I ever got closer to my dad in conversations or anything like that, but whenever we went anywhere in a car, anywhere. We held hands.
Wow. I will say that I doubt many adult children of troubled parents have an experience like that. I think it speaks so well of you that you, you know, moved your hand, that you took the initiative, that you were willing to be hurt.
Yeah. Well, and I'm so grateful. Here's an example. I'm so grateful for storytelling because I would have never told that story. I would have never, there would be no reason for me to tell anyone that except that, you know, a topic came up at the Moth, you know, love. And then I thought, well, that was an example of love for me. It was, and then, you know, and then now as time has gone by and I've told the story and people have said, hey, that helped me, you know, reach out, or I held someone's hand. I mean, it's,
I've heard that from listeners, from friends of mine that listen to those shows that have been moved by this story to make that extra effort, not knowing how it was going to go. And that's part
right.
of it.
That's
you
right.
You got to be willing to walk into the abyss.
That's exactly right. That's exactly
and
right.
And I'm glad for you that it paid off. And
thank
Harwood,
you, Greg.
Thank you once again for getting me all emotional on air when I'm trying to sound like a professional radio guy and not get teary. I know this is one of your favorite stories to tell. Can you tell us a little bit more about why?
Well, I you know, have a good friend, Tacy Rozalowski, who's a terrific just intellect, storyteller, writer, whatever. And she said, you know, you've told a lot of stories about men and I don't know if she said it or if it helped me frame what I did, but I want to encourage people to take emotional risks. Those are the hardest risks for us to take. You know, like we heard earlier from Elizabeth, you know, believe in yourself, you know, to take the risk to do what you really want to do, not knowing what the result is. You know, and just, I also just marvel. I mean, this is a very direct experience, but, you know, if you look at your hands, they are these amazing things that we have, this machinery, this biochemical machine that we're in. And you look down at all the things that we have physically, but our hands are marvels. Mm. And how cool that we have this ability to touch another person with our hand.
Now, one thing you and I have discussed at length, you know, is what I touched on, tip for the tellers, is that every storyteller has their own unique way of creating a story. Do you have a typical process you go through?
You know, I'm so grateful that I have, y'all know Chris Gorman, and she's my dear friend. And
another superstar?
Yeah, she really is. And you know, just practicing, and practicing with another storyteller and someone that's interested in it. I have a friend that makes film, too, Sean Welling, and I run stories by him. And I just, there's a group of people that I meet with Fridays that are writers and so forth, and they'll give me little tips. But I think, like, with this story, this was very much a sort of an instinct thing. And there was a part of me that said, I can't tell a story about holding someone's hand. That's the story. It's like, I'm afraid to hold someone's hand, and then I hold their hand, and the end. I mean, you know, and then, but if you know how important it is to you, and I knew how important it was to me, and then I thought about why was it so important to me. And then I thought, I don't ever not remember my dad's hands. There was something visual and tactile about this thing. And so, you know, it'll be different for everybody, but trust that creative vein, even if it doesn't seem like, you know, there's no car chase or there's no explosion.
Well, yeah, well said. You know what my least favorite question is when people ask me, what's your story about? Well, if you craft a 5 or 10 minute story,
right,
you can't say it's about when I got a flat tire. I mean, you know, just I've never figured out how to answer that question. I'm like, well, I can sit down and tell you the story, but I don't want to tell you what it's about.
Right.
Now, Elizabeth, what is your process when you create a story?
Well, I try to think of my audience, to know as much as possible about my audience. And not think about myself, but think about what I can give back to the audience, what I can share with them that would make a difference in someone's life.
Hmm. Ooh, I like that. Now, Joseph, you know, you're somewhat newer to the storytelling world, but I'd like to know, you know, how did you get comfortable creating your stories?
Well, you know, I think for me, I've never had an issue with public speaking of any kind, even from a really young age. Never been, you know, the shy type. But I think what's essential in storytelling is to experience life, to really try to go out of your way and do things and not be scared of anything, so to speak. And I try to instill that in like younger family members and friends, that go experience life. You know, those will provide good stories to tell. And on top of that, I think it's always good to be transparent and to show people you can be somewhat vulnerable.
And if you never leave your circle of comfort, you're probably not going to have that many interesting stories.
Right. You know? Right. Right. And and I talked to my good friend Julie, who's listening from Portland right now. This was one of the important things we talked about. People love when you're vulnerable, you're transparent, and they can relate to that. It's absolutely essential, in my opinion.
I could not agree with you more. Go on our Facebook page. Tell us a little bit about your story. If you think you have a story to tell, we would love to feature it on this program, and we'd love to hear from you. Thank you, Elizabeth Ruiz, Joseph Especia, Harwood Taylor, for sharing your stories and for insights that both engaged and inspired us. I am proud to have had each of you as guests. I look forward to many wonderful stories from each of you, and I have no doubt that from the time you leave the studio, you will be going out and experiencing life and creating new stories in your mind that I hope we will get to share with a future audience. And Joseph, we expect you to make return appearances whenever you find yourself back in Houston from Utah.
I absolutely plan to be back. Thank you. And Elizabeth and Harwood, your stories were very, very amazing, very moving. Thank you for sharing.
I enjoyed both of yours too, Joseph and Elizabeth.
Yes, and I as well.
Make great radio a part of every day. And while you're driving home, if you just need a little break from the day, if you're turning in for the night, or if you're just chilling out, join us every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. You keep loving a great story, and we'll keep bringing them to you. Above all, be good to each other. Tip well, even when you don't have to. Help when you can. The entire So What's Your Story team and I will always be searching for the next great story, and we will forever be reminding you that it is never too late to live happily ever after. Peace, my friends.
When you purchase the latest TV, tablet, or smartphone, don't forget to do the right thing with your old ones. Recycle them. The Consumer Technology Association and its members are making recycling your old devices as easy as buying new ones. Just go to greenergadgets.org, type in your zip code, and you'll instantly find the recycling location closest to your home. You'll also find recycling tips, like asking the store where you buy your new TV if they'll haul away your old one. Don't let your old tech tools clog your local landfill. Just visit greenergadgets.org. KPFT, Houston.
Hey. Whether it's the memories of great songs or the up-to-the-minute news and talk you've come to depend on, KPFT means something to you. It means something to our volunteers, too. They've decided to dedicate some of their time off to helping the station that's helped them. Volunteering at KPFT is more than just contributing time. It's about being part of something special, unique, exciting. Independent radio in a city where non-commercial